This month, we bring you news from the National Cancer Research Institute conference in Liverpool, the UK's biggest cancer conference. Advice on diet and weight could help bowel cancer patients. Research reveals that lifestyle affects the chances of suffering side effects from prostate cancer treatment. And we listen in on a discussion at the conference between two top cancer doctors as they discuss cancer care on both sides of the Atlantic. Welcome to the Cancer Research UK podcast. I'm Dr. Kat Arney. People who work in healthcare are failing to give patients crucial information about the link between obesity and cancer. That's despite obesity being the biggest preventable cause of cancer after smoking. Professor Annie Anderson and her team at Dundee University carried out several studies looking at how much guidance was given to bowel cancer patients about their diet and how comfortable doctors felt discussing the issue. Professor Anderson talked us through her results, which she presented at the NCRI Cancer Conference.
So in the qualitative work by cancer survivors, a very mixed bag of responses, with some people saying they would really have welcomed very specific advice about diet, particularly in the immediate post-surgery period, being uncertain what to eat, what their bodies could cope with. But in the longer term, being uncertain about how physically active they should do, would it do them harm to start jogging, or should they be looking after themselves by being more sedentary? So confusion, inability to source appropriate literature about what they should be doing and to find guidance on that topic. So the nurse specialists that they would see were not necessarily specialists in lifestyle, so feeling that they were kind of lost for guidance. But also patients saying that they ate very well and were very physically active before they got the cancer, so why would that help them at all? And wanting to avoid this sort of victim-blaming feeling, oh, they're big and fat, you know, they're being picked on because they're fat, and recognising obesity is a very sensitive subject. And we had this patient saying they would welcome advice to try and stack the odds against recurrence. We cannot say that by changing lifestyle we can absolutely prevent recurrence, but let's try and do what we can to reduce the risk.
Researchers have found that men with poor lifestyle habits are more likely to suffer serious side effects from prostate cancer treatment than those with healthier lifestyles. Men who had radiotherapy for prostate cancer, who walked briskly for more than 2 hours a week, played sport regularly, or attended a gym, were twice as likely to have no side effects and normal sexual function after treatment as inactive men. Professor Rob Thomas, who led the study, gave us his recommendations for men going through treatment for prostate cancer.
If you get a diagnosis of prostate cancer, particularly if you need radiotherapy or hormones, get referred to the gym, buy a pair of training shoes, and try to move more every day, at least 20 minutes twice a day if you can, or about 3 hours a week.
Blocking a key DNA damage repair enzyme called APE1 could provide a new way to kill cancer cells with faults in specific genes. The scientists showed that switching off APE1 could target cancer cells carrying faults in the BRCA genes, but left healthy cells unharmed. Although it's still at an early stage, this discovery is being likened to the discovery of PARP, which is now targeted by drugs in clinical trials to treat women with inherited forms of breast and ovarian cancer. Cancer Research UK's Senior Science Information Officer, Nell Barry, explains more about the discovery.
So what these scientists have done is looked at a new way to block DNA repair in cancer cells with faulty BRCA genes. And we know that these faulty BRCA genes already mean that the cancer cells are having a hard time repairing faults in their DNA. So if you block another pathway that helps them to do that, essentially you've taken away that ability completely. They can't repair their DNA anymore, and they're not going to be able to grow and divide and cause problems in the body. So we're hoping this could be a really promising way to treat cancers that are linked with faulty BRCA genes, so things like breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and even some kinds of prostate cancer. And it could be a good strategy for treating these types of cancer in the future.
And you can listen to a full interview with lead researcher Dr. Madhusudan Srinivasan from the University of Nottingham in a special Naked Scientist podcast broadcast from the NCRI Cancer Conference on the 6th of November. Just search the Naked Scientist website. That's nakedscientist.com to find it. Finally, Professor Paddy Johnston, a Cancer Research UK scientist based at Queen's University in Belfast, caught up with Dr. Murray Brennan, top cancer surgeon from America, at the NCRI Cancer Conference. We listened in on their discussion about the pros and cons of working in cancer care in the UK and the US.
I'm Professor Patrick Johnston. I'm Dean of Medicine at Queen's University Belfast.
I'm Murray Brennan. I'm from Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City, where I was chairman of surgery for 20 plus years, now run their international programs.
Murray, it's a real pleasure. Obviously, surgical oncology is and has moved dramatically over the last 20 years, and in a lot of ways you've been at the cutting edge,
to use the pun.
But I'd like to sort of hear from you, what do you think the big lessons in surgical oncology have been and where it's going?
The greatest advance, I think, is that we've made surgeons understand that they need to know more about what they do than the technique.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that they just need to know about radiation therapy or chemotherapy. They need to understand, which I think they now do, that getting the diagnosis right,
mm-hmm.
which is highly pathology dependent, is crucial.
So understanding the biology of
the disease. Again, we've made this phrase, as many others have, biology beats technique every single time. That if you don't understand the biology and you do the wrong technique, whether it's what you do with a drug or a radiation therapist or us with a knife, it won't work. And the second thing is that whoever's looking after the patient has to have a very acute awareness of natural history. That if you're going to intervene in a disease process and you don't understand what the natural history is, you'll almost always get it wrong. We want to put the multidisciplinary piece in when we're deciding what is the appropriate care for an appropriate patient. And then we want, when the patient walks in the front door, no matter which door he comes in, that happens. There's a trend in the United States to say, well, the patient should come and have four or five different consultations during the day with four or five different disciplines. As a chairman, that is totally cost impossible. I cannot afford that. I don't have the clinic space, I don't have the people power. So I actually don't want that to happen. So when people say, oh, we've got a multidisciplinary clinic and every single patient's reviewed by six or eight people at a time, I can't afford it. And so I think it's naive to think I can afford it, let alone the confusion for the patient.
I don't think the patient wants it either. The other big thing that's happened, especially over the last 10 years, has been the whole development of robotic surgery and imaging. But what are your thoughts in terms of where we are now with robotic surgery and the difference that it's made? And where do you see that going in the future?
It's actually a real risk because we have young surgeons who are fascinated by the technology. And it's very hard for them to place that technology in the context. It's still the same disease. There's no question that the advent of minimally invasive surgery, small incision surgery, is a huge plus for many patients. Robotics adds another dimension to that. But the key is to understand it's still the same procedure.
Mm-hmm.
It's done with less morbidity, less side effects. That's terrific. It's extraordinarily expensive. It is commercially driven at the present time, which is another thing that's a problem. There's no question it's here to stay, but somehow we have to bring it back.
Yeah.
It's of great interest, for instance, if you have a morbidly obese patient who historically to have a hysterectomy or a procedure would require a very large incision, often with significant morbidity. You take that patient and treat them with minimally invasive surgery or robotics, that woman can have a hysterectomy and be home the next day or the same day. That's a huge difference in consequences.
You've obviously got the albatross view in terms of what's going on across the world in terms of cancer surgery. You've been heavily involved both in leadership in the United States, but also you've been a global figure in cancer surgery.
You know, the UN has just had a major meeting in which they've committed to cancer in underdeveloped countries, much as they did with AIDS just 10 years ago. And look what happened when they brought a focus on AIDS, what a difference it made. And so now there is going to be, not as quickly as we'd hope, a focus on cancer in developing countries. It is the emerging problem. As we get rid of infectious disease, then cancer becomes, and cancer in younger people as we look at some of the demographics, we don't even know those very well, but in developing countries, the cancers are often advanced. They often occur 10 or 15 years younger than we see here. That's exciting for me because surgery really has a role to play there.
Yeah.
Because we aren't going to immediately put PET scanners in the middle of Uganda,
yeah.
But we certainly could put clinicians there. And clinicians who could educate other, not necessarily medical professionals, but people that could make a difference. So I think it is a global problem. I think it's going to be more and more a global problem. What about here in the UK? Well, as you know, the UK is a little bit like the US. You probably have the best of cancer care, and 10 blocks away you might have the worst of cancer care. So it's how we provide a standard of care that's reaches all of the populace. And you, as we have done perhaps 30 or 40 years ago now, have an extraordinary ethnic mix.
Mm-hmm.
You have pockets of the population that are new immigrants, much as we do. We often are culturally insensitive to their needs, as they are to our professional behavior. So it's an exciting time to look at that. Not all going to be solved very easily. We're beset by the financial difficulties, as I mentioned. I think it's tragic. The analogy I usually use is that the US individual pays about $7,200 a year per person for medical care. In Cuba, not arguing for Cuba, they pay $700. For a tenfold increase in expenditure, we have a lesser life expectancy. That's a problem. Now, it's not just a medical problem, it's a societal problem, but it's a problem. And so we have to come to grips with some of those issues.
One of our big challenges that's come through a lot of the cancer registry data and cancer intelligence network data is that it's the clinical access. Mm-hmm. It's getting the patients seen quickly, making the diagnosis in a timely fashion. It seems to be where the biggest roadblock is, and also the thing that's going to have the biggest impact. And so one of the challenges in the UK is to make patients and indeed society more aware of what they themselves can be doing to think about cancer early, and of course our general practice community, our primary care physician community, to be thinking about cancer in terms of the symptoms that patients have. So that's one of the big thrusts that is currently ongoing right across the UK.
Well, that's an important one because, you know, we know that minorities, and in our case the African American, have worse outcomes for almost all cancers. And when you begin to dissect that, one of the major factors is access to good care. So it's not just that they have, quote, bad genes, it's the fact that they have limited access to care, which is a problem. And the only way to do that is to move cancer care into the community. We had a number of outreach programs, for instance, in screening mammography for breast cancer. We thought we were being very altruistic and providing free mammograms to people. And of course, what we learned was we could get the patient to come and have the mammogram, but if the person communicating the results didn't speak the language of the patient, or even more, were unaware that within 6 months, 80% of those people would have moved from the address they gave the first time, we failed for a purely societal event.
I mean, we have very similar things here, and particularly in SE groups 4 and 5 in the inner city.
Mm-hmm.
It's even down to language.
Mm-hmm.
And the cultural perception that sits in communities. If you have, like, for example, some of the mobile screening
right.
units, if you're seen going into some of those, you suddenly are stigmatized.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So there are really simple things in our society that actually make people afraid to take the initiative, in a sense.
Well, it seems a shame that you can get your driver's license for a taxi driver in New York City, I think at last count, in 13 or 14 different languages.
Yeah.
But your opportunity to see a doctor that speaks your language is minuscule.
That was Professor Paddy Johnston speaking to Dr. Murray Brennan at the NCRI Cancer Conference. You can read more about the conference on our Science Update blog, scienceblog.cancerresearchuk.org, and we'll be back next month with all the latest news.